KPBS On Demand is supported by the National Conflict Resolution Center. Geopolitics, a divisive election year, and strained budgets are all topics that can create tension in the workplace. NCRC can help workplace leaders navigate polarizing issues with the Culture, Communication, and Conflict Certificate. More at ncrconline.com.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. It is a normal part of aging for women, and yet there are so many questions about menopause. Today, we'll speak with a panel of doctors who have answers. I'm Jade Hindman, with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. A new legislative proposal would make education about menopause more accessible to clinicians and women while also making care easier to get.
The word menopause isn't a dirty word anymore. You know, people are just talking, people are talking to their friends. That's wonderful.
We'll talk about ending the stigma around menopause and take some audience questions. That's ahead on Midday Edition. For many women, menopause and what to expect in all of its phases draws a big question mark, because while most women will experience this phase of life, getting answers to questions and just finding care can be a challenge. Well, right now, state lawmakers are pushing legislation to make menopause care more accessible and to spread awareness about the transition. I'm joined now by a panel of doctors to talk about all of this. Dr. Cynthia Stunkel is a clinical professor of medicine at UC San Diego. In 1988, she established one of the first menopause clinics in the U.S. at UCSD. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Jade.
Also, Dr. Catherine McCauley, clinical professor of medicine and OBGYN at UC San Diego, and she's also director of their menopause health program. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Lisa Lipschitz, OBGYN with Sharp Grossmont Hospital. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
All right. So, Catherine, there's two menopause-related bills working their way through the California legislature right now. Let's first talk about AB 432, which would expand what treatment insurance companies are required to cover related to menopause and perimenopause symptoms. But before we get into the specifics there, I'm curious, what does treatment currently look like?
Well, one of our more commonly used treatments for menopausal symptoms, particularly for vasomotor symptoms, which are hot flashes and night sweats, is menopausal hormone therapy, which consists of estradiol or certain versions of estrogen with, if a woman has a uterus, then she also takes it with progesterone or a type of progesterone. So typically the estrogen can be either oral, transdermal through the skin, or vaginal formulation. So there's a variety of different formulations. Patches, gels, like I said, rings, vaginal rings. So there's a variety of options for using hormones, but that would be what we usually start with in a patient who's a candidate and having bothersome vasomotor symptoms.
Lisa, we hear these terms, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause. What does different treatment look like over that cycle?
So perimenopause is when you still are producing your own hormones, but very erratically. And so my goal during that time, if people are symptomatic with either irregular bleeding or hot flashes, night sweats, is to really try to make their hormones stable. And so if they're a good candidate, I often prescribe oral contraceptives, or sometimes I prescribe hormone therapy, although we can get into bleeding problems with that. So it's a discussion to be had with the patient.
Yeah. What makes a patient not a good candidate for like hormone replacement therapy?
The major contraindications for, so there's birth control pills or hormones that we use to, or hormones that, those have different contraindications, but hormone therapy, the major ones are unexplained vaginal bleeding, breast cancer, if you've had a history of a clot or a clot in your lungs, other contraindications if you have cardiovascular disease, like you've had a heart attack or a stroke.
Wow. Cynthia, so back to that bill, AB 432, it requires health insurance coverage, evaluation, and treatment options for perimenopause and menopause. So how would that improve patient care?
I think one of the important things that could be added would be to just help with patients having confidence that the treatment that's recommended to them would be paid for. And that has been a challenge with some of the postmenopausal hormone therapies. I think people are used to giving younger women oral contraceptives. Now, during the menopause transition or the perimenopause, there's also some interest, especially if women are having bleeding issues, of using something like a levonorgestrel IUD, which thins out the lining of the uterus and can really reduce those bleeding issues. And then if at the time the woman develops hot flashes or some mood changes, some of the other symptoms of menopause, then we can add an estrogen therapy on to that combination. So she gets contraceptives, she gets the bleeding cuts back, her symptoms can be relieved, and that levonorgestrel IUD can help protect the lining of the uterus from the effects of estrogen, as Dr. McCauley was mentioning, that if a woman has a uterus, she needs to have a second hormone to protect the lining of the uterus from overgrowing and possibly even developing into an endometrial or uterine lining cancer if she's had too much estrogen over a prolonged period of time. So the bill, I think, is going to be helpful because it's hard sometimes to get things like, for example, a transdermal patch, which is one of the options that is really coming into more favor now because we know that it has very little negative metabolic effects on things like on things like factors that affect our blood pressure, the lipid profile, blood sugar control. And so more and more experts are recommending transdermal therapies, but they haven't always been covered. So I think that my goal or my hope would be that this would enable women to just be able to obtain these treatments in an easier way and have it mostly covered as we expect our insurance to provide for us.
Yeah. Well, and even if they're not covered by insurance, do a lot of women, are they even told about these therapies from their doctors if it's not covered?
Not always. Not all women, in my experience at least, are given the full sort of spectrum of options. It really is shared decision making in terms of when a woman decides what formulation she wants to use. But it is really nice to have coverage for all the different formulations, as I was saying, a patch, a gel, a pill, a ring, because one formulation might work better than the other. But then sometimes, yes, we're I'll discuss it, but then we go to order it and see it's not covered. And that just makes it tricky.
Mm. It makes it expensive.
And very expensive. Yeah. Exactly. So the out-of-pocket costs for some of these products are really just out of range for the majority of women. And these are patients with insurance and able to afford health insurance. So it's just the price is a challenge if they were to actually pay out-of-pocket. So we really do need improved coverage.
Well, you know, Catherine, let me ask you this, because this bill also, you know, it has that other component. It requires doctors to go through menopause-specific continuing medical education. So what are your thoughts on that aspect?
I thought that was an interesting thing to have in the bill. I think that, yes, I agree with it. I think I'd like to see there be better menopause education earlier so that we didn't have to require continuing medical education for, you know, already licensed physicians or providers. So I do a lot of work at UCSD teaching the medical students and residents, as many around the country are in different academic centers. That's starting to improve finally, but it's slow. So for now, yes, I think there is a need for better menopause education, especially now with more people talking about it, patients asking about it. So the bill, to my understanding, if the provider's practice had more than 25% of women in their practice under the age of 65, then they have a small percentage of their CME time, that continuing medical education, that should be completed on a menopause topic, which I think is really appropriate if they have a large female population in their practice.
I just wanted to say that we learned that one of the only randomized controlled trial, the gold standard scientific research to try to evaluate these postmenopausal hormones, was first published more than 20 years ago in 2002. And the results initially were surprising and they were negative and they led to fear in women and clinicians. So it's not just our new providers in training, be they physicians or nurse practitioners or physician assistants. We got to get back at those practicing clinicians who just were in that wave when people said, we're not doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. And they kind of never learned. And so that's why this really appeals to me to tie it in with CME, because many clinicians are just so busy that it's hard for them to prioritize what I'm going to do. But this might be a little nudge. And just by virtue of them having to do this, I think it can really increase their confidence and they'll do a better job being able to talk with women about the menu that's available that they could use for symptom relief, as well as the risks and benefits and how they know it's appropriate, what's most appropriate for each person.
Right.
Or just even putting it on the radar for physicians, because like Dr. Stunkel said, in the past, there was so much fear because of this flawed study. And now you have all these doctors and other providers that just don't know what to do. So just as long as you, if you just give them, hey, it's okay, and even if they don't do it themselves, at least they feel comfortable to refer to someone else, and it's in their wheelhouse of, hey, this is something important.
Dr. Stunkel, speaking of that medical training piece, there's another California bill, AB 360, related to that, and it requires the state to report on gaps in health provider education around menopause. So how could that influence treatment?
Again, I think if people are informed and are educated, they are going to be more confident and more willing to say, gosh, you're 45. Sometimes women start having symptoms about this age. Anything going on? Are you having hot flashes? No one teaches us what these things feel like. And I've had patients say everything from, I'm having panic attacks. And I go, why don't you describe those to me? Well, my husband's a psychiatrist. He says this are panic attacks. She's having just a standard run-of-the-mill hot flash. So some clinicians may not be so familiar, and either younger women or our male colleagues. So I think that's going to be really helpful. The other thing is that people need information to combat this current rage of the influencers. Everyone's selling a supplement. Everyone's got a new formula. These things are not required by the Food and Drug Administration to be formally tested with placebo-controlled trials, the sugar pill versus the active treatment. And we know that hot flashes are very responsive to placebos. So I want to know that this stuff that's being sold has been tested. And I think that a clinician who's more informed and educated about kind of what the real experts are saying versus the, like, movie star experts or other people who decide, I'm a menopause expert now, right. To help them say, you know, I hear what you're saying and you're bringing me this newsletter or whatever, but let's talk about this and we could have a good conversation about what's evidence-based and what's trendy, but we have no idea.
Right. And let me ask about that, you know, because there are so many people online who, you know, will tell you they're a guru about menopause now. So many, you know, reels and videos. And I think I'm wondering if the fact that a lot of doctors may not be educated on that right now, and perhaps more people are turning to the internet for information about menopause. Is there harm in that, or does it, or is there good in that?
I would say there's harm in that to some degree if they're not getting reliable information. And I think, yeah, with the education of providers, as Cynthia was saying, how important that is to get them sort of up to date with menopause. I've had some providers telling me they're looking at different online influencers or reading their books, and there's not always accurate information from some of those people who are even physicians. Some of them have turned it into a business with books and products and supplements and become very, very popular in social media and other outlets. But at the end of the day, it looks like a lucrative business. And so I have some issues with that.
But Jade, I would say that and I agree with everything that Catherine just said. But I think on the good side, it's getting people talking about it. It's getting it out there. Women are talking to their friends. Did you hear about this? Did you know about that? Do you know anybody who's tried this? And I think just that, opening it up and making it part of just what people are talking about is a really good thing.
Dr. Lipschitz?
I agree with that. You know, there's pluses and minuses. I think the plus is it's really out there now. No, the word menopause isn't a dirty word anymore. You know, people are just talking. People are talking to their friends. That's wonderful. Now, the next step is to make sure that what people are learning is really accurate and is beneficial for their overall health and causes no harm. I agree with Catherine. I mean, there's so many people out there making a buck, and that's not quality care. So we need to have experts, professionals who know all the data, who know all the science, that really can prescribe things. You know, a holistic approach is not just prescribing, but really, how are you going to manage this part of your life and what are the best tools for you?
After the break, we'll get to some of our audience questions and comments. Stay with us.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Splitero, helping homeowners pay for home improvements by offering streamlined access to your home's equity with no additional monthly payments or new debt. Splitero provides a lump sum payment in exchange for a share of your home's future value. Pre-qualification available at Splitero.com.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. This hour, we are talking about menopause. And right now, two bills are making their way through the California legislature to expand treatment. We're joined by a panel of local physicians to talk about menopause and help us better understand this very common process. I'm speaking with Cynthia Stunkel, clinical professor of medicine at UC San Diego, also Dr. Catherine McCulley, clinical professor of medicine and OBGYN at UC San Diego, and director of their menopause health program, and Dr. Lisa Lipschitz, OBGYN with Sharp Grossmont Hospital. So, Dr. Stunkel, in general, what do many people get wrong about menopause, and why do you think there seems to be this cloud of mystery around it?
Well, having lived a long life so far, I think one of the things is that women fear that menopause is going to be associated with aging, that you're going to, like, lose your game and that you're just not going to be who you were. And that makes me so sad. I was fortunate when I started out in this realm a long time ago that there was a woman named Margaret Mead who was a very thoughtful anthropologist. And she said that women should embrace this time and celebrate their postmenopausal zest. So instead of looking like, oh, gee, I'm older, I'm aging, you know, I want my sexy back kind of thing, that women really, it's like a time. And we know that this transition occurs. We used to say that women have a third of their life after menopause. I think for some, with our advances in aging medicine, we might be living half our life after menopause. So I don't want to be mourning for half my life. I want to be celebrating that. So the simple things, you're not in aisle number 3 of your Walgreens shopping for tampons anymore. You're not worried about contraception anymore. You're not having bleeding issues that, you know, necessitate that you've got to pick your wardrobe accordingly to the time of the month or plan your activities based on, you know, terrible heavy bleeding. So in so many ways, and I think it coincides also with a really rich time of life for many of us, that you're kind of getting really established professionally and hopefully established in your family and people that you love and the way you want to spend your life. And I would very much rather women look at this as kind of like a gift, a special time. And I think one thing that has helped is there's so many celebrities that are letting us in that they are menopausal. You go, really? Seriously? She's postmenopausal? So I don't know. I think the one of the main things that we need to do is kind of look for a little shift in how we think about this, how we approach it, you know, not so much with dread, but curiosity, you know, and ultimately celebration.
So does the brain fog and mood swings, hot flashes, do those all go away in postmenopause?
It depends. For the vast majority of women, I would say yes, but there are a group of women, probably 18 to 20%, who may have hot flashes literally a very long time. The brain fog, my best understanding of the data is that that clears, that this is something that is in your rearview mirror after a few years. And the mood changes often are reflective. If you have hot flashes at night, you're not sleeping, sleep deprivation can really contribute to a poor personality and tolerance for stress and anger management issues in all of us. So if those things are back in check, unless a woman really has a history of vulnerability to depression, so if she's had a postpartum depression or really has a rough time with the second half of her menstrual cycle, she may be more vulnerable. But for the most part, these things resolve.
That's optimistic right there.
That's coming from the other side, Jade.
Okay, all right, so. There we go. All right. Well, you know, we asked our audience members what they wish they knew about menopause before they went through the process. Naomi Lake pointed to perimenopause, so take a listen.
I am through menopause, and I wish I had known more about perimenopause. It's all about possible symptoms and when it can possibly start, how long it can last. That would have been very helpful. I know it varies woman to woman. It can last up to 10 years prior to full-blown menopause. But I think it's crucial women understand these possible symptoms better so they can talk to their GYN or primary care person and not feel like they're losing their minds.
So, Dr. Lipschitz, I mean, what are those signs of perimenopause that get confused with other health conditions?
I'm just going to step back and just talk about what's going on so our audience really knows. So really what's happening is it's the end of a woman's reproductive potential, and those ovaries are slowing down. And eventually when you hit menopause, you no longer are able to get pregnant, which sometimes makes people very happy. So what are the symptoms? So what's happening is your ovaries are really acting erratic, and you're having major fluctuations in your hormones. The results of this, it varies for every person. But I would say the biggest one that I see is irregular periods. And at first, the periods kind of clump together and get closer together. And then as you get closer to menopause, they kind of space out. And so this irregular bleeding is really bothersome to a lot of women. And while this is going on, all the symptoms of perimenopause that you also see in menopause, you see those as well, which is like the hot flashes, the night sweats, the irritability, mood changes. That's especially common in people who are prone to mood disorders. And then difficulty sleeping. And as we said before, when we're having trouble sleeping, our whole life falls apart. So if we can help women sleep better and help them manage their mood better, so many other things are going to fall into place. Now, the hot flashes, too, can contribute to sleep disturbances. And at this time, you're getting older and you're aging. And as you asked me, you know, maybe it's your thyroid. So you should get some labs checked as well to make sure you're not getting confused of what you're actually treating. And that's why a trained doctor or advanced practice provider can really do the other test to make sure that there's nothing else going on.
Is there a specific test that one should ask for if they go see their doctor?
There is. That's a great question. There is no actual test that really confirms perimenopause or menopause. We do have a hormone that we sometimes use for patients who have had their ovaries taken out, who don't have bleeding. So we really don't have other ways of telling if they're perimenopause or menopause.
I was going to say the problem with doing a test, because I think we have so many tests for so many things. You're just like, can't you do the test? But as everybody's been saying, it's not like an on-off switch for this transition. And so you're kind of chasing a moving target that women might go a couple months without a period and have some hot flashes and come in and go, I'm sure I'm postmenopausal. And then you order the pituitary hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone that regulates the ovaries, and comes back completely normal. She goes, Dr. Stunkel, I needed to tell you I had a period 2 weeks later. So you just catch them, and it can be a waste of money. It doesn't help. And so that's why, in general, most of the medical societies and expert groups say, you know, try to resist the temptation to measure these things, because it doesn't necessarily help us in the management. But I really agree with what you said, Lisa, about other things are happening in our bodies. So we don't want to just blame it on menopause. And there's some other blood disorder that's causing all this bleeding, or thyroid disorder. You know, we have to be smart about evaluating just overall health of women at this time.
So, but if there are no tests, then how does hormone replacement therapy work? Like how does one know how much of a specific hormone they may need to take?
Menopause is a clinical diagnosis. So it's 12, as I mentioned earlier, 12 consecutive months without a period in a woman who's in that right age range, then she's reached menopause. So that's how she knows, I don't need contraception anymore. I've reached menopause. Any bleeding after that point should be reported to a provider. That wouldn't be expected. But the general guidelines for prescribing hormone therapy, we have a lot of different dose ranges for estrogen, and that's shared decision making with the patient as well. If they feel more comfortable starting with a low dose, and then we usually titrate the dose up to relieve their symptoms, because that's really what we're interested in, is symptom relief, not levels.
I do want to get back to some more of our listener comments. As you've all laid out, there can be a whole range of symptoms associated with menopause. And our listener, Julia Nemeth, had something to say about that. Take a listen.
I wish my healthcare provider would have recommended HRT first. Given my age, the weight gain should have been obviously menopausal rather than wasting precious time and money on weight loss programs. Given my age, the sudden onset of anxiety, depression, and disordered sleep should have been obviously menopausal rather than putting me on water pills, blood pressure medicine, and sleeping pills. I feel like I'm fighting a war with various doctors to treat menopause rather than all the separate symptoms.
So, Dr. McCauley, what are your thoughts on what Julia just shared?
Well, I agree with her. I think it's challenging when we have menopausal hormone therapy, if we, you know, correctly identify that the woman is in menopause and recognize the symptoms. And we have menopause hormone therapy that really can cover a lot in terms of symptom relief in a lot of different systems in the body. And I don't like the idea of adding multiple medications to treat one thing at a time. I'd rather use one hormone therapy that would cover a multitude of different symptoms and would really get to the root of it. Mm-hmm. So I agree with her. It's very frustrating. And I see a lot of patients come to me having been offered non-hormonal treatments first rather than being given the full spectrum of there are non-hormonal treatments that you may prefer, but there's also menopausal hormone therapy. But as I think Cynthia was talking about earlier, there was just so much fear after that 2002 WHI study. And a lot of providers were just very concerned about risk, that they became averse to prescribing hormones. So we're now just seeing that tide changing.
I was just going to say, I think Julia's comment reflects and really kind of brings us full circle to this issue about clinician education. Some clinicians just didn't learn it. They don't know it. They don't want to necessarily reinforce that this is menopause because they're not sure what to do with it. And so I think that women should also know that hopefully that they have the resources to get a second opinion. If they feel like she's slamming into this door and then that door and this problem and that drug, to just step back and go, something's not right here. And at least, you know, ask sometimes a clinician will even say, you know, I haven't had a lot of experience with this, but I've got this person in our plan who really is into menopause, so let's get you in to see her or him. And so pushing back and looking for a second opinion if they're having such a rough time.
Hmm. Well, this next comment is from Leslie in San Marcos. Let's take a listen.
I wish there was more information relayed by healthcare providers or from the media on the relationship of menopause and osteoporosis and other postmenopausal related diseases. I've learned too late that osteoporosis could have been prevented if better educated at the time of menopause.
So Dr. Lipschitz, tell me, what is the connection between menopause and osteoporosis?
So as we start to enter the menopausal transition, we are losing bone slowly, slowly, slowly. And one of the ways to prevent bone loss is with menopause hormonal therapy, primarily the estrogen. And of course, you need the progestin if you have a uterus. When we stop the estrogen, the bone loss continues. Now, to actually treat bone loss at this point, we're not using estrogen to actually treat what we call osteoporosis, which is severe bone loss. But to prevent it, estrogen does wonders. And I really appreciate that. I really appreciate Leslie's comment, because I think what's happening, unless women bring it up, lots of patients get left behind. And I think just like we have preventative exams for certain times of life, like at certain, you're supposed to be getting mammograms, you're supposed to be getting pap smears, we should be screening people for menopause and having a discussion about how can we help you to maximize not only your symptoms, but your long-term health.
Is there sort of a list of things that one should consider once they reach perimenopause and then on into their postmenopausal period, in terms of like the changes that they need to make for their life, like what they eat or do?
Lifestyle is considered, and we had a meeting at the Menopause Society meeting a few years ago, and we had a talk that was called Lifestyle, the Silver Bullet, implying that it's so important on so many aspects of life. I like to think that the menopause transition or the menopause itself is what we've called it sometimes the portal, so a passageway to the second half of life. And so even if for the women who are listening who go, gosh, I feel lucky, I'm not having a lot of symptoms, it's still happening. And so it's a really good time to step back, take stock, and look at your health overall. I think it's an opportunity if you're going to be seeing somebody about your symptoms to say, like, is my blood sugar okay? How's my blood pressure? Women, our number one concern is heart health. So we need to be focusing on those kind of standard risk factors. Is there cancer in my family? Do I have a genetic predisposition to cancer? What kind of screening should I be doing? You know, how's my mental health? And then, again, the lifestyle kind of things. It's never too late. It's never too late to engage in moving your body if you haven't been a fan of doing that. And so I think, again, looking at this as an opportunity, not just the sad, bad news of a reduction of ovarian function, there's a lot of good things that can happen.
All right. Well, Dr. McCauley, one listener who wanted to remain anonymous asked, what a husband can do to support his wife going through this process. He says her mood swings have caused him to seek counseling and that he misses his wife. So how can concerned loved ones support people who are going through menopause?
That's a great question. I think if they can be understanding about the need for a cool bedroom and keeping the temperature really low, and maybe understand that, that may improve over time, but that, well, it might be a permanent thing with the cool bedroom and sleep. But supporting their partner in encouraging them to find a doctor they're comfortable with to talk about the symptoms. And I sometimes have spouses come to the appointments too. Mm. We haven't talked that much about sexual function, but sometimes it's related to that. But a lot of times, they're there for support or there to maybe describe what they see, you know, if the wife is comfortable with that in terms of mood changes or other symptoms. But I think just, keeping communication open and just being supportive and encouraging them to see their provider.
Dr. Lipschitz?
I just love that question because I think men should be more involved. They should be educated too. The more our society really understands about menopause, the more as a society we can move through it. And so many women are in relationships with men, whether it's fathers or partners or sons. It's just important that everybody gets educated. So I love that question.
One of the things that Dr. McCauley mentioned was some sexual issues that can come up when our estrogen levels decline, it can reduce the amount of moisture in our vaginal tissues. And so it can become uncomfortable to have penetration or intercourse. And so this can be complicated, and someone either might not know that they're in this transition, or they just kind of feel like, I lost that love and feeling. But it can make them avoid sex sometimes. And if when that happens, that can be very complicated to a relationship. And so, again, keeping the conversation open, helping women to appreciate that this could be a symptom that they're having of vaginal dryness, and that they don't necessarily need to take what we call systemic hormone therapy, though that certainly would help with hot flashes and vaginal dryness. But women can have a great deal of relief from vaginal estrogen application and a number of different ways to do that. And then there are a couple of other medications that are available that specifically address vaginal symptoms. So that's an important factor to have in mind. I think some of our clinicians, I always tell the medical students, be bold. Ask her, are you having vaginal dryness? And they're like, oh, I don't know what I'll say, but I'll go just, you know, say, well, this isn't really my wheelhouse. I want to be a cardiologist, but I know who to recommend that you see, because, you know, get it out there on the table so that they can get relief, because it works really well, very safe. And sometimes women have recurrent urinary tract infections. That's another thing that can kind of go on with some of the urogenital effects that can occur.
What about libido? Does that fluctuate during this time?
It does. I mean, it doesn't necessarily fluctuate, but it's a common complaint. There have been studies looking at this decreased libido that causes distress, and the menopausal years is a time when it peaks for women. Sometimes the decline, if sex doesn't feel good, then there's going to be probably not much desire for it. That's it makes sense. So we usually will address the pain first, as Dr. Stunkel was talking about, using the vaginal estrogen or DHEA products that we have available. But if it's just a decline, I have many women who feel like, no, same partner, he's wonderful, there's no stress, no new stressors in my life, no new medications that I've started, sex doesn't hurt, but I'm just not interested. So it's something for women to be aware of, and that the body things may change, but can still be improved.
Coming up after the break, how the menopausal transition is depicted in the media and how we can fight stigma. Stay tuned.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Splitero, helping homeowners pay for home improvements by offering streamlined access to your home's equity with no additional monthly payments or new debt. Splitero provides a lump sum payment in exchange for a share of your home's future value. Pre-qualification available at Splitero.com.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. On today's show, we've been talking about menopause and the transition before and after, the good, the bad, the ugly. I'm speaking with Dr. Cynthia Stunkel, clinical professor of medicine at UC San Diego. Also, Dr. Catherine McCauley, clinical professor of medicine and OBGYN at UC San Diego. She's also the director of their menopause health program there. And Dr. Lisa Lipschitz, OBGYN with Sharp Grossmont Hospital. So we left our conversation talking about libido and sexual function. And so we talked about some of the treatments to help with that. Are there any other treatments?
For libido, for premenopausal women, there's actually two FDA-approved treatments for low sexual desire, or another term is hypoactive sexual desire disorder. The name has changed a bit over the years. And casually, we call it low libido. But for postmenopausal women, those two products have not been extensively studied, so they're not FDA approved. So we do use some off-label therapies to help with low libido, such as testosterone. Just needs to be carefully dosed and monitored properly to avoid side effects. For some women, that's the missing piece, and that could be effective. I also talk to my patients about sex therapy. and seeing a therapist who specializes their practice more in that area. And we see more providers out there that offer that type of therapy can be quite helpful. And I give them resources, books that are helpful in just understanding the changes in sexuality over time. So there's certainly resources and treatment options that can be effective.
I think women need to also just cut themselves a little slack. This is an incredibly compressed time of life. A lot of women have teenage kids. They may have older parents who need more attention. They hit that midlife level and may have some struggles or frustrations in their work or in their home. Couples can have money issues come up for the first time, looking at the tuition for their kids or whatever their house finally needs done, and they can't put it off anymore. And so there's so many things that it's no wonder that that people may lose interest or have challenges with sex. The other thing is, I think a lot of women have changes in their body. Women don't all gain weight, but things can move around a bit on a person. And so there's a redistribution of the fat on our bodies that can alter, I think, our sense of, you know, how sexy do I really look and things like that. So again, I think we need to just cut ourselves some slack and take a break from our lives. And things like that can be very helpful too for just putting some vim and vigor back.
Yeah. All right. Well, another question for you, Dr. Stunkel. I want to circle back to something that came up earlier, which is the influence of media and pop culture. So here in the U.S., women are constantly bombarded with anti-aging products, supplements, $100 skin creams. How much of that seeps into your work?
I think all of it. It's just kind of impossible. What I see that is most disturbing is women used to ask questions in their when they hit 50 or maybe their 40s, and now women in their 30s are developing this like insecurity about impending menopause and what should I do and will it be okay and doing different, you know, Botox when they have perfect faces. So I'm kind of concerned with that emphasis that's so pervasive now and kind of can erode women's self-confidence that I feel is unnecessary and certainly premature when they think about that. So having a, you know, I guess we could talk to younger patients and say, maybe you've been thinking about this, maybe us be proactive. It's hard because not everyone has time in their practice to have these kind of longer conversations, but to kind of soothe a little bit, provide some reassurance that, you know, they're on a good path with the other things that they're doing in their lives to give them some confidence about coming up on this.
Dr. McCauley, anything to add?
Well, I also remind my patients, too, when they come in their 40s and ask, you know, what can I do to prepare? Well, other than I usually like people to really work on lifestyle, diet, weight, try to enter menopause at their ideal body weight. That's one thing I talk about. But I remind them that I see so many women. I have a big, busy practice, and not all women have terrible menopause symptoms. So I do remind them that, you know, this isn't always what it looks what people describe with terrible moods and irritability. And yes, there's symptoms. And yes, you need to know what they are in case you have them and need to address those. But some women go through the transition very smoothly and don't have a lot of symptoms. Maybe they had a couple hot flashes. So it's not always a terrible experience. I have many women, they only come in once a year and they kind of laugh, well, I did okay. I didn't need really much. And or maybe they just need some vaginal estrogen, but not the full-on hormone therapy. So it's variable.
All right. Before I let you go, I want to get final words from each of you. Dr. Lipschitz, I'll start with you.
I'm just so excited to be sharing all our knowledge with the audience. And I hope everyone who's listening has gotten something out of it and will be proactive on their own journey.
Dr. Stunkel?
I like to challenge women to come up with three questions. If they're going through this, if they're symptomatic and they want to look for a solution. Number one, how bothered are they? Are they completely off the charts that they can't function? Things aren't going well at work. It's a mess at home. Or it's just like, this isn't so bad. Number two, what do they want? Do they have an idea in their mind of what that best solution is going to be for them? And we know that women have a complete spectrum of based on their other interests and experiences. And then number three, to ask their clinician, will my choice be safe? Is this safe for me? And I think that's part of what we can offer women is to look carefully at the choices and what else is going on with their health and then advise them about that. So I think those three simple questions, how bad are my symptoms? What do I want? And will this choice be safe?
Dr. McCulley?
If there's other providers, healthcare providers listening, I would just really encourage them if they don't feel totally confident with their menopause skills or experience that they're the Menopause Society is a great resource. There's lots of good resources out there for education, even if this bill, hopefully it will pass. But if it doesn't, that I think that we really, really need more providers in this space. And it shouldn't just be that there's a few experts that take 10 months to get an appointment with. Really, we want more primary care doctors, endocrinologists, OBGYNs to feel and advanced practice providers to feel comfortable in this space. So, I would just really support that continuing medical education in that area.
All right. This was a great conversation, and I so appreciate you all. I've been speaking with Dr. Catherine McCulley, clinical professor of medicine and OBGYN at UC San Diego and director of their menopause health program. Dr. McCulley, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jade, for having me.
Also, Dr. Cynthia Stunkel, clinical professor of medicine at UC San Diego. She established one of the first menopause clinics in the U.S. in 1988 at UCSD. Dr. Stunkel, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Jade.
And Dr. Lisa Lipschitz, OBGYN with Sharp Grossmont Hospital. Dr. Lipschitz, thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.